guys, Roberto and Alexander. We have this is Sweeney versus Bard at Parallax. My job here today is to sort of to host a conversation between, let's say, South America and Sweden, or Colombia and Sweden, two philosophers who, I understand Roberto's written a book called Age of Anxiety, and that your philosophies have synchronicities or have similarities. So I'd just like to hear first, maybe Roberto, if you could just, introduce yourself, say who you are, say what your concerns are, and maybe your relationship to Alexander's philosophy, like we were talking about in the before we started began officially. So please,
Okay, thank you.
welcome.
So my name is Roberto Palacio. I'm a Colombian philosopher and a writer too. Last year, 2023, I wrote a book called The Age of Anxiety. And basically, my concern, as we will probably speak about here, are, let's say, collateral aspects of all that's happening with our age. So one of them is certainly anxiety. We live in an age that people are very anxious about many things. And my concern in that book is with this peculiarity of our way of living. Why is this happening? So it has to do with identity. It has to do with our relationship with virtuality. It has to do with our relationship with argumentation and education and so on. I don't think I'm a real expert in America Latina and in Latin America, but I'll do whatever as much as I can to help you understand what's going on around here.
Thank you. Yeah. So why are we so fucking depressed?
It
In
has to do with
general.
so many things. Just imagine a world in which you're standing in front of a microphone. This is just one aspect of it. You're standing in front of a microphone and you're screaming to the world, "This is me, this is me, this is me." And you're really desperate to be read out and for other people to read you and really take you in. But we do not want the pre-recorded applauses. And the world is not able to give us that because everybody is basically doing this. And we don't have a whole bunch of people interested in reading others. Everyone seems so interested in giving others their message. That's just one aspect of it. It's just one. But if I could briefly take another aspect of it, we love to avoid having to play out the complete trick. So we love avoidance. And if the child is standing in front of the pool and the mother says, "Jump in, it's not so bad," we live in an age that ultimately says, "You don't have to do it, honey. You can just stand there." And when if you read Kierkegaard, it's so goddamn interesting that Kierkegaard, he signals out anxiety is all that happens before sin. And if you put it in context, you take away like the theological aspect of it, anxiety is what happens and what comes all before the that you have to actually perform the feat. So I think we live in an age of much anxiety because of many aspects like these.
I should add here that I met Roberto the first time at a conference in India, and it was striking that we were both presented as speakers at the conference as non-Americans, which if we, when you're non-American in India, they will applaud it because it probably means you've taken an interest in India and Indian culture before you arrived, which Americans tend not to, right? Americans are like the top of the hierarchy. They just think their American culture is what everybody's interested in. So that was fun. So we got along really well. I think it was in Rajasthan. I met the first time like Roberto. And I knew who Roberto was. I hadn't met him in person before. I knew there was a strong kinship in our work. There's a certain alignment here with Gilles Deleuze and Félix Guattari's work from 30 to 40 years ago, certain line. But I would say It's great that Roberto mentioned Kierkegaard here, because if you take my last three books, Jan Sudeikis, if you take Synthism, Digital Libido, and Process Event, that we return to many of our conversations, Andrew and I have, then I would say go to the second one here, Digital Libido, and think of Digital Libido as a book that tries to create a social theory around the predicament at the arrival of the digital age. Well, the perfect complement to that book would be Roberto's Age of Anxiety, since Age of Anxiety takes a much more existential approach. Like, imagine you take Byung-Chul Han, the Korean Zen monk who we're all reading these days. You know, he's a very grumpy guy. That's probably why he's popular too. He's very, very grumpy. But if you take the sort of Byung-Chul Han, also very existential approach, and apply it onto social theory, or what it means to live in this very confusing age, this paradigm shift, we're living right in the middle of that paradigm shift, then I'd say then you just arrive at a rich wealth of ideas coming out of Age of Anxiety here.
I was thinking as you were talking about Camus as well, and I was thinking how he kind of declared that you could become a saint without God or something. That there was a sort of like, and if I think of that, that would be like, would create a lot of anxiety, in me. And I wonder if this is connected to the sort of individual notion that of existentialism, of overcoming and that kind of thing. Or am I off here?
Sure. For me, it certainly is. And Camus was a great inspiration for me. There are many aspects that are so relevant in existentialism, not only also in Sartre. And such aspects are, for example, well, we can speak about this later, the difference between narrating something and the reality of this something. And if you read Sartre carefully, he is so careful. He is so focused on saying narrating something always changes the something, and it makes it look so much better, and so on. But Camus, it was so interesting for me because if you read Camus carefully, his diaries, for example, there is this idea of the great pursuit of sense, and. And we are looking for sense, and there is no place in the world in which where we can find sense. There is the silence, what he calls the silence of the world. But as I see it, back then there was at least this, let's say this pride of not living in a world with values. Now we don't even have that. I think Alexander magnificently in Process and Event, he squares that out. He explains that so well with figures like the boy Pharaoh and the pillar saint and this Gnostic delusion. What's happening? What's going on? It's inevitable that we live in an age of great anxiety. It's inevitable that we live in an age of great, I don't know if depression necessarily is more acute in our age than in other times, at least in this part of the world. It was called 100 years ago nostalgia, and they would send people up to a farm and they would have them there for some
Nostalgia
time.
was called depression before.
Yeah,
That's interesting.
here in Latin America, it was called nostalgia. And if you go back to the 16th century, it was melancholia. And I don't know if it's worse now, but the symptomatology of our time certainly is, it has to do with many lateral aspects of what Alexander is working, as I understand it at least. Boredom it's a central issue in our way of life. Anxiety is a central issue in our way of life. Very acute forms of hatred are central to our way of life. Why? So the great question is why? What's happening? And it's not easy to see. We understand things that happen. We understand much better the French Revolution now than people living it probably. You know, it's 200, 300 years ago. We understand those processes much better. But if we're asked about what's happening today, it's so difficult to understand. It's difficult to get a grasp on it. And I think you, with your ideas of the sociant and so on, you have traced the way of understanding. It's not the only way, but you've traced the path where there was no path. So I find it so interesting.
So if we go back to the era that shaped us, which was this long, long, long period of hundreds of thousands of years, and we're genetically shaped when evolution actually had an effect of us, which is, of course, prior to civilization, which is a very short period. Whatever we call civilization, agree on, it's only a few thousand years that hasn't really affected us biologically at all. We're still pre-civilizational, biologically speaking. So if then the storytelling and the sociant was done late at night, it was a small audience, like thinking of like a small local theater, and certain people were appointed to do this. They were elders and they were artistically talented, and they gave us the narrative about ourselves as a sociant, as a tribe, which is to say that the word sociant is used in archaeology to describe the original nomadic tribe. So we have a word for that. The original nomadic tribe is a sociant, which apparently the nostalgia is a nostalgia for the sociant itself. It always is, right? So we
Yes.
live in a completely different world now, technologically different. Everybody in the world, 8 billion people, are now directly connected to one another. And if you only go back some 50 years or 50 to 100 years ago, back to Sartre and Camus and the existentialist, they came out of a society where suddenly affordable reading, affordable writing, and affordable accounting had become universal. So you've been to school in Europe for the last 100 years or so. You could read and write, you could express yourself, but there was still an enormous threshold to become a writer and to publish a
Yeah.
book. There was an enormous threshold towards becoming a proper journalist to write for a big, say, French daily newspaper like Libération or Le Monde or something like that. So these were intellectuals, Camus type of intellectuals, who are a small elite of people who had access to tools with which to express themselves. And of course, their entire endeavor was a massive sort of post-Nietzschean Freudian negation of Christianity. And in Christianity, you were given your specific place within the world, and you were supposed to work really hard 6 days a week and go to church on a Sunday because it was a feudal idea. And then you would be rewarded by going to heaven when you died. And that was it. Now, of course, these guys are now living in a universe where there is no life after death. It's obviously gone. There is no Christ to save you. The church is falling apart, falling into corruption, disrepute. We see all the results of that now, of course, 50 years later, where the Catholic Church is imploding more or less. So they knew this would happen. They knew the Catholicism was overdone with. And what they were doing, they were sitting there post-religious in their nihilistic mode and trying to explore what that would be. Kierkegaard had been ahead of them. So when existentialism arrives, we go to the 1940s and 1950s, we have a small elite of writers who are basically concerned with how can I write as well and as honestly as possible? This is the question that Sartre, this is why we read them now. What has happened over the last 30 years is that this has now become so affordable that everybody in the world has a microphone. Everybody in the world has their own camera. Everybody in the world is trying to make media. And of course, like little kids, we're now little cuckoos sitting in a massive cuckoo's nest, shouting for attention. And we're not getting any because there's no audience.
Yeah,
There's
no
this
one's reading.
empty
Yeah.
scream right out, and there's no audience. And I could say this to a 19-year-old, and they said, finally, a philosopher who speaks about my world. This is a world that any 90-year-old girl or boy, you know, today would subscribe to. This is the world they live in with social media and everything. And I think if there was an anxiety before that Sartre and Camus discussed, it has just basically exploded over the last 40 to 50 years, leaving us with the world as a huge cuckoo's nest. We're all screaming for attention and nobody's coming.
Yeah, our crisis is a crisis of readers, but I do not refer only to people that read books. Not only to that, we are not reading each other, and we're desperately producing a lot of stuff, but we're not reading each other. So, but we want that recognition. We desperately want redemption. Something that Nietzsche understood so well is that we want redemption. And we want it in an authentic way. But what I understand and what I've been writing about is that our mechanisms, the mechanisms that we have to recognize ourselves, the recognitions that we have, the mechanisms that we have to manage and to succeed in this redemption do not seem fit for the redemption we want. They are mechanisms that belong to 100, 200 years ago. Who is identified with their education today? Almost nobody. When you read the letters of Abelardo and Eloisa, they are so goddamn happy to be educated. And education, it means so much that they actually named their child Astrolabio. Terrible name for a child. But we don't
It was
have that
still
today.
expensive. It was still expensive to get the
Yeah,
education.
yeah.
And once it got cheap and became abundant, its value fell. And here's the trick. If we're not getting the attention we want, and we're not even getting a critical review of our seeking of attention so we could go somewhere and be part of a larger society where the attention is rewarded those who should have it, we don't even have that. So what we created is a highly commercialized society that replaces recognition with kick-seeking. So what the computer tells is that you cannot get recognition because there's nobody there to recognize you, but we can give you kicks. And I would say, therefore, we have what I call the ADHD society, where Byung-Chul Han would agree that if you're on the horizontal level of the ADHD, it means that you start tons and tons of products to get that damn recognition, and all you could hope for is to get a kick out of one of them occasionally, which is usually a replacement for the recognition, and then you fall back to the place where you started. Now, if you start 15 different products in your life and you go in the other way to try to, achieve those 15 products and you fail at all of them, you're not going to fall back to the same position. You're going to fall down lower. And then you're going to try harder. And then you're going to fall even lower. And then you end up with a vertical axis, which is manic depression. This is like fundamental to psychoanalysis. Manic depression is the state you arrive at, depression, nostalgia. And this is the nostalgia to at least get back to where you started from, which when you were a kid and you tried to do different things, you had a playful attitude towards life and you were seeking recognition and maybe even got it from your mother. But now you live in a grown-up world where there are no mothers left, even if you look for them. There's nobody there to applaud you because your mother is probably busy herself trying to get recognition for whatever she's up to.
Yeah, sure. And
Just go ahead.
see, please.
Well, I was just thinking as you're speaking, I like very much the idea that education used to be a redemption. In other words, that was the purpose of education. It was more almost religious activity, whereas now it's to get a degree or whatever. I also was thinking about Marshall McLuhan, and I was thinking about he talked about the numbness of when people go numb. He called it auto amputation. When people are like, first of all, we in the written age, people were numb to they became very very text oriented, and they became numb to sensation and experience, and now he says we're moving into a second kind of orality where we have all these visual sonic, experiences, and we're numb because rather than having too little information, we're in the age of excess. We have too much of everything all the time. So anyway, those were my thoughts while you guys were speaking. I wonder if that jives with anything.
No, that's so relevant, Andrew, because that's precisely the problem with education, that we have too much of it and too little of it at the same time. And we have too much of it in people in the universities being over-specialized in these APA quotations and all this stuff. People that have, I don't know how many years of postgraduate studies and so on. And at the same time, we have so little education in schools and in, I don't know how to call it, in companies and, business communities. That's like the right way to say it. We have this contrast, and we desperately need what Aldous Huxley, more than 70 years ago, called pontifices, pontifex. The church created a very intelligent institution for its purposes that was the pontifex. The pontifex was a person in charge of creating bridges, constructing bridges between the earth and heaven. And this is a lesson we should learn. We don't have this in education, for example, and we desperately need someone running through the little boxes and trying to establish relationships between things. But I want to go back. That's the thing about education. All redemptive institutions like the church eventually become something that we just have to go to get saved. You know, we have to go to mass every Sunday or we're not going to be saved. Did you hear the priest? No, I don't know what the guy said, but I was there. I was there. Just check my name. I was at mass on Sunday. And education is becoming something like this. But I want to go back to an aspect
Can I just add one thing there, just as a parenthesis? This is exactly what I mean when you go from education as redemption. I agree with Andrew. That's a fantastic description of what education really is. It changes you. You change in the process. You go from young and energetic to old and wise. Your life journey is about this education, right? Like you flower because of it. To exactly, there's a point you're supposed to achieve it, and then you get a kick out of having achieved it. You get a reward of having achieved it, but you don't even understand why you did it in the first place, except if somebody told you you need to go there and you need to get that kick out of it. So the reward system, it functions. So you achieved a certain point, but because you don't even own the journey there, you don't even know why you're there. Your box is isolated from the other boxes. There's no pontifex there, as there is in a monastery. The pontifex goes to the monastery to explain to the monks and the nuns how their work is related to one another. You know, the monks and the nuns are the ultimate nerds, but somebody needs to go in there and say, your work over there, his work over there, her work over there are related to one another. This is how you create the sort of the sacred socium of a monastery. Now, you don't do that in education institutions at all, because basically they're set up according to capitalist criteria, where each department is fiendishly competing for resources with the other compartments without anybody knowing why the university is there in the first place.
Yeah.
So, yeah, education as redemption, we need to go back to it. Sorry for breaking in there. Roberto, but I just had to emphasize that the kick seeking is obviously there as well. Young students today come to me and think that education is kick seeking, just like everything else.
Sure. Yeah.
Just like everything else they do. They don't
just
understand
like
it's
else.
For them. It's for them. Mm-hmm. It's about who do you want to be? I get up in the morning, have a cup of coffee, and can't stop reading books and newspapers. I love getting educated, and they don't even understand what that means.
For me, well, this is just a stupid commentary, but I've been a teacher for so many years, and I've discovered that students consider their grade something like a salary. So they don't want the salary to go down, and accumulated averages are something like accumulation funds and so on. And institutions are giving them just that. But I would like to go back to something that I consider so relevant in this discussion, and it's our redemptive desires and how they sort out in the world. And we want redemption, of course, but we don't want to pay the price for it. Of course, so many things that we want depend. You see, there's not any real change without vulnerability, but we do not want that vulnerability. For example, in relations, emotional relations, we really want to be recognized by the other and really want to be loved by the other. But we don't want the, how do you say it in English, the In Spanish, it has such a nasty name. It's called the tusa. It's like this harsh feeling of when you break up with someone. What's the name in English for that?
Separation or divorce or
yeah, when you separate and you're feeling really bad, and it's like a
Oh,
No, I
you
can't
just
over.
crushed. You just crushed in
You
English,
don't want to
for
be
sure.
crushed.
You don't want to be
You
crushed.
don't want to be crushed.
Yeah.
Yeah.
You'll cry
But
like a fruit that all the juice has been squeezed out. It's just torn apart. It's basically you're crushed. Yeah. Yeah.
But my goodness, real redemption through love, for example, and we could put the example on other things, implies this risk, implies this vulnerability. And we've constructed a society that really eliminates vulnerability.
This
So,
is it. This is Byung-Chul Han's point, and that's exactly why the biggest industry today is the therapy industry. Because what you do is you're told to never look vulnerable to the people you are actually dependent on. And then you take your vulnerability professionally somewhere else to see a therapist who's paid to try to make you less vulnerable. And basically, that's what therapy is all about. So the porcelain can pretend that it's made of cement, right? And this is Byung-Chul Han's point. Why else would the therapy industry have exploded over the last 30 years? Why would we brag about going to see therapists? We tell people we're seeing a therapist so we can avoid looking vulnerable to them. Because then if we start looking vulnerable, they can say, well, why don't you go and see your therapist about it? So they don't have to deal with it either. So then we have these facades. And the human race become these facades of successful people with successful faces. Then you top that off with social media, where every damn picture of anything we do in everyday life has been enhanced. It's like we're trying to keep ourselves above the surface of a pool we expect to drown in, because we think if we don't keep up appearances, then we can't stay on top of that surface, and we believe that's how life should operate.
And that's the critique, yes, for sure.
This is totally different to go and see the priest in the confession chair. The confession chair is part of the redemption process. And I can assure you that any good priest ever you went to see for redemption in the confession chair would send you right back into life to educate you. That would be always be the advice for anybody who did confession. Confession was always about, I didn't know better. And the result ethically would be, well, next time you will know better because you made a mistake. Now get up again, try again, and this time you're educated. This is why I think education and redemption are closely tied to one another.
Just what I was going to say briefly before I pass it to you, Roberto, was I was thinking about our course called The Hard Way, and this is intentionally anti-marketing because I think the rules of marketing are you don't make something hard, you make something easy all the time. So there's a challenge that in something in education that needs to be, sacred.
We should
A
add that
challenge
it's.
has to be sacred. Just last point, and that. And actually, the vulnerability is, so it's like the, if you that makes you makes makes you soft at the same time. So it's like you have to have that balance, I guess, between the hard and the soft way, or become soft people instead of just personas, facades, what Alexander was talking about.
Yeah, we should say that the hard way is a course held by a fantastic Australian brother of us, again, a non-American named Luke Benke. He's amazing. And of course, the central theme is Gurdjieff and Gurdjieff's teachings. And I would definitely think of Gurdjieff as a response to Roberto's books. If you say you read Age of Anxiety, which is a necessary critical study of contemporary society, you must start there. You must understand what's wrong. You must try to grasp that first, to then pursue your own personal hard way, for example, the Gurdjieffian way, which is why there's such a great interest in Gurdjieff these days, because he's the first guy in the world that would tell you to turn off your fucking smartphone and get back to reality, right? That's exactly what Gurdjieff is becoming so big.
He had a phrase called conscious suffering, so it's not just becoming, this nice, perfect persona. Or anyway, I think he has a very good analysis of anxiety as well. And
I would say even better. I think Gurdjieff is the perfect antidote to learn how to come down from the kick. Because I think the other side of this, if we want to go back to education as redemption, as what's shaping a human being, which is brilliant, to go back to that, we have to understand that the kick-seeking mentality we become addicted to, we're addicted to the addiction itself. We're all made addicted now, like almost everybody is. To I deal with ADHD, but I deal with highly intelligent ADHD patients who learn that this is not a disease, but this is a condition based on information stress. Meaning you don't need the medication when you're in the wilderness or when you do martial arts. You do lots of things we've done historically. Once you're in the sentient, you don't need it. But once you're in a modern city, once you go online, you will need this medication because otherwise you will not be able to handle it. And they get the picture. So they get the full picture out of that. And then they understand that the problem they will have once they get the medication is to learn how to come down from the medication to go back to the sober state every day the rest of their lives. If they fail at that, if they stay with the medication when they should not take it, they're becoming drug addicts. They become drug addicts. And this is why your work, Roberto, I hope my work with psychiatrists fits into a larger picture, a larger social critique, where we're now trying to go to guys like Gurdjieff to find guidance for those who are really willing to go through this. And I said, Gurdjieff is the first guy to tell you, you need to learn how to calm down. You need to go into conscious suffering. Yes, you will suffer when you come down. Learn to live with it, because otherwise you can never afford to get up on that high again. You can never go back to that peak experience in your life if you haven't first learned how to come down from it.
Great phrase, information stress. I think that is the cause of ADD.
It's not a disease at all. ADD, ADHD are expresses information stress. And if they're untreated and if you're unaware of them, they will lead to manic depression. And that's where I think a lot of the depression that Roberto talks about in his book actually starts with this whole bizarre, question of what are you going to do with your life? Who are you going to be? And we're asking it to everybody. And we're asking to everybody in isolation. We're basically training people to be kick-seeking cuckoos from day one. And the frustration this leads to is perfect for capitalism simply because the perfect consumer is always the most frustrated consumer. Because then they will consume much more than they need. They will consume out of desperation to fill all that, to fill all those existential holes they have with just anything they can consume. And without ever succeeding at it, they'll go back to the consumption repeatedly. This is the exact opposite of education as redemption. This is what people want the redemption. This is what they need the redemption for, to get out of this loop.
I was thinking about what something that Andrew said, and that you mentioned too, Alexander, and it's the hard way, let's put it that in those terms, the hard way of living. And we philosophers should listen much more to marketing, really, than we are doing it right now, because marketing, some people in marketing somehow know before everyone else what's going on. There is this trend in marketing that's called frictionless living. And frictionless living is basically a strategy to help, of course, sell products and to create brand meaning. And they have discovered something that's absolutely, but at least to me, it's astounding. People really buy things when there's no friction involved. But that's not the astounding thing. The astounding thing, what is friction? Having to speak with someone else is friction. So it's really, if you put it all in terms of just having to click something, write down your name and have a chat, but you don't want to hear another human being's voice. So that really helps to sell products. And points of friction are other people's voices. Wow. That's flabbergasting. What does it tell you about other people's how we are affected by other people's presence? And we really, I was thinking, I don't know, my ideas up to that point, I really don't understand. Is there maybe the idea
Well,
that
I
how
can give you a
people.
suggestion, Roberto, and see what you think about it. I think we do associate human relations with the sacred and the private, and the commercial sphere is totally located in the profane and the public. So I By the way, what you just said is absolutely true. We have an enormous, enormous addiction problem here, especially among young women in Scandinavia, age group between 18 and 23. And they don't only arrive at psychiatric emergency care units, totally confused. They also arrive with huge loans. And they've been online, spent the entire night online the last night, not just scrolling on Instagram, because that's at least cheap, even if it's very addictive. No, rather they've been shopping. And they're compensating for whatever they have in their lives by shopping. And they're shopping without seeing a single human being, which is exactly when they're vulnerable for the whole shopping procedure. Their entire kick-seeking system is then installed, and they're rewarded with the kick when they've done the shopping. And then they go shopping for more to get more kicks. And of course, the whole point with the shopping is to shop clothes and shoes and makeup and shit to make them look stronger when they enter a public and profane arena. And that's
Brilliant.
exactly why they don't want to meet another human being in the process, because they associate the shopping with the public and the profane, or their public and profane persona. And they then all, the entire generation of young women, walk out into the public and the profane, competing like mad at one another, using the skin creams and the clothes and the shoes and all these signals to try to outperform the other girls in the room. No, none of these girls ever understood this. None of them have ever seen it. They think their mothers had the same experience when they were the same age. They're totally convinced that this is how human life is. They don't understand how extreme the situation is and how the marketing people have pulled them away from anywhere where they could talk to anybody, which still has a sacred and a private sphere to it, so things can be questioned. Like when you have your friends around, your friends are sacred to you and your family is private to you. So when you're surrounded by the sacred and the private people you know and trust, you will then critically look at, for example, a purchase of an item. But by removing your friends, not the salesperson, removing your friends, removing your family, removing the people that are dear to you from the process, leaving you alone and therefore very vulnerable in front of your laptop, your smartphone, you are perfect for the marketing guy to just sell, sell, sell.
Yeah,
I think we
sure.
arrived at that stage. I think that's something very clear. I have the data to prove it, to be honest, actually, to show it, because then when you start looking at the girl's behavior, it is the online shopping that really is their huge new addiction. And compared to the mere scrolling, which was bad enough, this is even worse because this also ruins them. They're ruined. They take loans on SMS and text at exorbitant rates, and they get ruined.
Yeah, it's interesting how like the shopping mall and the movie theater and these temples, right? For people, in a way they were temples, are gone now. They're empty. They're ghostly inside, and there's nobody there anymore. Just a few people kind of wandering around, and so everything is.
It's a very simple formula and equation you can put on Tinder. Once Tinder was established and became a global success, it made it easy for people to have sex and made it much harder for people to love.
Yeah, or let
Why?
go.
Because it isolated you from social context. It even isolated your picture and had your picture swapped without you seeing it. So you wouldn't have to know that 95% of the people of the opposite gender didn't want to sleep with you. You wouldn't have to know. You weren't given the bad news. You were only given the good news, which is perfect for marketing people. The good news that there were some people out there who found you attractive.
Yeah,
And
all the
then you're
friction, right, is gone, right? This is what Robert was talking about, right?
and then you're sitting high on that experience. Like, oh my God, there are so many women out there who find me fancy and could consider having sex with me. Wow, I had no idea there were so many women out there who love me. Well, reality is that we only got to those women by throwing you more or less naked or vulnerable in front of millions of women, out of which the vast, vast majority said, no way I'll ever get close to that guy. That's not what Tinder tells you. And slowly it creeps on you after you use Tinder for a few months that there's something fishy going on here. It's getting harder after a while to get that kick out of Tinder as you used to. Well, you only get the kick because you're in deep denial of the refusal that you're actually instrumental to, the fact that the people do not want you. And this is again and again what the marketing people today are using the online world for. They remove all the bad news, keep the little good news they're in there, and then push it up like mad in our faces.
Yeah, you use the word friction, right? Again, Roberto, and all the friction is pushed out of the equation, which makes it smooth. Another word from Hahn, he talks about everything becoming smooth. Do you want to continue on that thread or?
Yeah, well, it's so interesting. And in the case of Byung Chul Han, of course, the maximum example of this is the smartphone. And the smartphone, of course, makes everything reality look so much smoother and easier, of course. But one thing that I've been writing about and thinking about is that we usually think that we're migrating to this zone of unconditionally migrating to the zone of frictionless living. But what one discovers, I don't know, and I throw it on the table here as something we can discuss. But what one discovers is that we are in an opposite trend too, to take things out of the virtual existence and show them in the real world. And try to be recognized by these things in the real world. So if you this great big void, as Alexander describes it, that's Tinder, for example, this great big not knowing really what's happening, we're also on a path that's going backwards, and we're trying to show the world what we are. So, for example, I was flabbergasted to see that the sculptor, Italian sculptor Salvatore Garau, some months ago, he sold an invisible sculpture for $18,300. My goodness. And he's made some five of them, Afrodita Piange and Buddha in Contemplation and so on. And there, it's just a piece of tape on the floor. And they're exhibited in museums and so on, and in piazzas everywhere. But people do buy them.
I would add something here. We've had these conversations with Owen Cox and Raven Connolly and you, Roberto. You're also a member of the Intellectual Deep Web. Anybody listening to this conversation, contact us if you want to join. It's a fantastic forum. But Raven Connolly and Owen Cox, their argument for the dark renaissance as basically what art is going to be over the next 50 to 100 years, is that the internet itself and the marketing people there have made enhancement of reality their standard. And the more they can enhance it to make it look attractive, that means it's become absolutely impossible to have any sort of enhancement techniques in art any longer. Because it just looks dirt cheap right there. Oh, the perfect day, the perfect weather, the perfect strange planet, the perfect life, the perfect relationship, the perfect smile. We hate it. We hate it so much because it goes into the spam box with everything else that marketing people try to force on us to have that sort of frictionless living. I agree with you. They've already tried the frictionless life. It is a dream come true for marketing people that we could have a frictionless life. And yes, to a certain extent, I don't want friction in my life. When I use my dishwasher or my washing machine, I want minimum friction. That's exactly why I paid to buy these machines, you know. But when it comes to frictionless culture, it's already impossible. It's already impossible. The enhanced picture that AI can make out of anything is it, we got tired of Midjourney in less than 3 months. It became so predictable. So I would say definitely I would agree with you, Roberto, and I would see a clear sign of this movement in art. I think even if we had Gothic and all that, and we were sort of always fascinated with the Draculas and the vampires out or whatever, and we had Gothic and we had emo culture and all that, that's just the beginning of what we're going to have over the next 50 to 100 years. I think art is absolutely impossible unless it is connected to the Gurdjieffian hard way. Unless it's connected to a society of friction. I think friction is where art has to start. And it will be a massive reaction against this sort of abundant, cheap enhancement that we see everywhere in pop culture.
Yeah, and it's not only in art. Because if you take a look at other aspects of what's going on in the world, I don't know, Kim Kardashian lives in a 5,000 square meter mansion that's virtually empty. What does that mean? She goes to these prizes in a spandex suit that covers even her head as a green prop. My goodness. So what's going on? What are we saying with these things? And I think we're on a path back from virtuality to the real world in a certain way. We want to be recognized, but by what we are doing on the web, and we want to that recognition in the real world too, in a certain way. And I've been focusing on that and how it happens, even in a political sense. I think we're on a path. We're not totally in the web yet. Look at what happened to Meta, and it was it really didn't work. Selling things on the web, you can buy a terrain and a virtual reality. Look at what happened to NFTs. They really didn't work. But of course, we're not there yet. We're trying to come back in a certain way, be recognized in the real world too. And that implies friction, of course.
It also means we need to come down from the biggest mountain. We can't all climb the Mount Everest. We are only going to climb local hills. We're not going to climb a huge mountain, all of us. We need to understand that the global empire is strictly a technological phenomenon, deeply inhumane, does not make any sense to any one of us. I even believe America and China will fall apart before the century is over because I believe those systems are way too large to contain the very local cultures that are coming. I agree with Jim Rutt on this one. I think local communities is the shit. We stopped going to the public arena online about 5 to 8 years ago. The early adopters dropped it 8 years ago. Everybody else left 5 years ago. When the corona kicked in, we were interested in the public arena just to get instant information because we had a worldwide pandemic. That was the end of Facebook. After that, nobody's gone back. We've all gone into closed rooms. We want to know who we talk to. The kids today are doing nothing but chat channels. They're on Telegram and Signal on chat channels. They want to know exactly who they talk to. They want a small group of people. They don't want any trolls. And trolls is basically people who have nothing better to do but to try to ruin your conversation. So the public arena is dead. Now that's scary. Because we did have a public arena when everybody read the same newspaper in the same language every morning, and they got into political discourse about how to run society, and you could go off to any church alike on a Sunday to handle your spirituality. That was a lot easier because we did have a public arena. Now, when we come back to a point where the public arena has imploded online, and we've all gone into silos and echo chambers more than ever. And we're all going local. At least we're looking for the sociant. And I think this is the only way out. The only way out for each one of us is to go into our own specific local cultural sociant and find alignment with the people there that we can socialize with. But as far as the public arena, it's dead and over. And this is terrifying. It's terrifying for the politicians I talk to. The politicians themselves have always had an audience who will always be taken seriously, at least by the journalists of the big TV stations, of the big newspapers. Even the politicians will not find an audience where they're speaking any longer because there's no public arena left. So the downfall of social media has been so rapid, and social media has been replaced by what we could call local social media. We just call it the chat channel, basically. Or we have a forum here in Intellectual Deep Web where a few hundred people we all know who's in that forum. We all know each other. And that's exactly the kind of environment where you can speak freely and you can be creative these days. The problem is that none of these places are a public forum. There is no nation of France left. There's no nation of Germany left. There is certainly no nation of the United States of America left. There are just these different silos that are cooking, and they're at least better than the people who run it completely on their own.
Yeah, of course, because there's really not a notion of public good in. And that's something that politics was so based on this notion of public good. And then that public good could be expanded, and that it was something you had to participate in. And as a citizen, you were somehow a part of, or a participant of this public good. There is no notion of public good anymore. So there, what can you construct politically on that? You can't construct politically on that.
No,
And it's
the politicians and their parties just become interest groups among interest groups. We don't expect them to be anything else. Like, it's almost like an African economy in the sense that if you get the job, grab as much as you can and give it to your family, your relatives. And that's exactly how you corrupt the system. It's deeply problematic.
I saw that you were going into the list, and you were starting to read the list, Alexander.
You mean Deleuze? I've always read Deleuze. I was a huge fan of Deleuze and Foucault when I was a kid, and I guess I'm very indebted to both of them, in my thinking, in my work. Yes, absolutely. They did social theory much more creatively and much more fun than other guys did. I think that was the attraction. I don't necessarily always agree with them. I agree more actually with Foucault than with Deleuze, to be honest about it, because I think that Foucault is a structuralist and very misunderstood. Americans don't get Foucault at all. They've all read him wrong if they read him at all. And he's very useful in that sense. He was not the grandfather of woke in any way whatsoever. He was a Nietzschean. He would have hated woke, if anything. Foucault was proud about himself. And it was Foucault who said, live your life as if it's a work of art. He didn't say, live your life as if you're going to steal somebody else's resources. Live your life as if your life is a work of art. It's the most non-woke thing you could possibly say. So that was Foucault. But I find Deleuze and Guattari inspiring. I can get tired of their anarchism, but they're useful in the sense that they do try to practice what a Nietzschean mentality could be like for a collective. And in that sense, I think they're really, really useful. How about you? What's your relationship towards
Well,
Deleuze?
I have a problematic relationship there because I do read them in this way that basically are saying, well, there a certain fact has an infinite number of interpretations, in which I do agree, of course. But there is no reason to prefer one interpretation above another. And I see in a certain way wokeism stemming from there. And I do find it problematic. And we have not overcome that in the last 30 years, what they were saying.
I agree. Deleuze and Guattari came out of the French Revolution. No, the Paris in 1967. Obviously, it was not the revolution. It was the failed revolution. But when all these young Frenchmen were running down the street trying to look sexy and thought
The
they would
May
change the world
68
forever.
revolutions.
It was Maoist or whatever. Sartre was in there too. And Lacan refused to take part in it to his, we should say to his credit. Lacan refused to take part in it. But anyway, this was 1967. Deleuze came out of that, and there was a certain naivety, which of course colors his books with Guattari. And this is where, when I read Deleuze and Guattari today, and I'm tired of their anarchism, I'm tired of the naivety. And it has a closer relationship to Herbert Marcuse. And Herbert Marcuse, if anybody, is the grandfather of woke. So there's a relationship. There's a Rousseauian attitude there towards life, which is dead wrong and which we cannot afford. So I agree on that one.
I got a question. Alexander brought up the notion of dark renaissance as a reaction to, let's say, false luminosity or everything being okay, and the kind of the smooth culture that Han talks about, and so the need to deal with the darker aspects of our existence, and does that resonate with you, Roberto, or?
Oh, sure, it absolutely does, because it's absolutely naive to think that we can just dispense all the hatred, all the bad words, all the misogynistic commentaries, and so on. Well, we can't do that. Where have they gone? Where are they? They didn't just disappear magically. It's a fairy tale world. No, and really you start to find out is that these things start to underline and many of the aspects of our lives. The hatred on the web, well, that's where these things are right now. You just can't magically dispense with it. It's such a naive idea to think that we can make the world a so much better place without paying a price for it. Now we're absolutely harmonious. This Chinese idea of harmony, my goodness,
Terrible,
what to
like a
make of that?
totalitarian yin and yang kind of
Yes,
thing.
it is totalitarianism, but it can be imposed because it seems such a good idea. Harmony, social harmony, and it's basically just tyranny. It's our forms of tyranny. I think that tyranny today is it can be resumed in one basic idea, and it's that you are guilty of things that you cannot avoid. That is tyranny today. And if you speak up or if you see things that you cannot unsee, that's very Orwellian, and I'm very Orwellian in this point. Well, that's a form of tyranny. But who is against this? If you have to be really mad to be against this form of social harmony. But of course, we can't. The price is paid elsewhere when we impose this. And that's precisely, I think, what's happening today.
I agree here because the phrase, you're guilty of the things you cannot avoid, leads directly onto an ontology of guilt. You said you're guilty for who you are. Since
Yeah,
then,
that's
what
it.
is unavoidable
That
is
is
who you are and
precisely.
cannot avoid. You cannot
Yes.
avoid being this. So
And that's identity
we declare you're
politics.
guilty. That's
And pure
exactly.
Maoism, isn't it? I mean,
Jacobins, the Jacobins, French Revolution, it's Maoism. Yeah, it's a Trotskyite among the Marxists. It was Mastak. It was Mastak. We know Mastak from the 6th century in Persia. Almost the entire Persian Empire collapsed because of him. He was also a great inspiration for a certain Muhammad 100 years later. So this is also the foundation for Islam, which of course is the perfect religion to combine with woke culture. So it is that life could have been different than what it is. And if life had been different, it would have been better for me. Therefore, I wish that life could have been different. But because it isn't, I will then force onto the future the requirement that the future is nothing but the justification of what went wrong in the past. Like if you could,
That
and like
is.
if everything that the future is dealing with is to readjust the world according to an old standard should have been. This is the exact opposite of Nietzsche's Amor Fati. The exact this is pure resentment. That's exactly the way Nietzsche would look at it. And it's been big. It's always come back at these vulnerable times in history, and it's coming back now with a vengeance. And here's the point. If we take the cuckoos we talked about earlier in this conversation, and we're all sitting like cuckoos screaming for attention, and we're not getting the recognition we think we deserve, because we've been told we deserve recognition for just attempting to scream. Okay, so you're sitting like a cuckoo screaming, you're not getting recognition. Of course, the next move is then, well, I should have recognition because I've been told I deserve it. I refuse to believe anything else that I deserve it. Then I will do anything I possibly can to get the recognition. That means if you go violent, you can defend it.
Yeah, sure. Sure.
That's the beginning of all fundamentalism
That
starts this way. All
is
fundamentalism starts this way.
identity, that's identity politics, as I understand. So
Yeah.
you are guilty because of your identity. You cannot shake it off. There's a big difference here in this new form of dogmatism and times that don't have really big, you call it the phallic gaze. There is no vertical organization of any kind of truth, are very dogmatic times. And I think that there's a big difference. If you look at communism 80, I don't know, 100 years ago, 110, 20 years ago, well, the communists, they accepted this idea with people had to suffer for this. The first person that proposed it was Rosa Luxemburgo, that she was, besides that, a great botanist. But there's a difference between the position of your class position and your ideological position. And this permitted that the Communist Party really advance in a certain way because you could accept people that were radically, they were born in a certain social class, and you could accept them. And they had a real advantage. And even if you go back, Christians, or when we had the Inquisition and Torquemada, and if you repent, there was this public ceremony of repenting. And you were later on burned at the stake too. But what the hell? You were burned being a perfect Christian. What we don't have today is this, because I cannot resign from being male, white, 50 years old, and so on. I cannot resign from that. I can stand up. I've been in ceremonies of such nature in which men stand up and resign to their privileges. But this doesn't make them biologically different from what they are. So new ideologies can't really accept the other. That's the base in which I find something so radically problematic in Islam. You were talking about Islam a few seconds ago. And that's the base that unites maybe wokeism with Islam. Islam is just, you've said it, extremist populism, right-wing wokeism. And it's the impossibility of accepting the what is radically other, what is radically different. And why? Why is that in Islam? Well, it takes a certain quest to find out. But Islam really didn't have what Christianity has. In Christianity, God gave his son to the people, to men, to mankind. And this made through the figure of Jesus, God was not the radically other, this thing that is incomprehensible, that can't be really represented, whose name we can't even say. God became something that was akin to humankind. Islam does not have this and will not ever have it. What's the first principle of Islam? There is no God. There is the God. My goodness. Oh, my goodness. And that leaves such a big space. You can be holy, or you can be a jihadist, or you can make a bomb explode in a public space, and God is going to be elsewhere.
Well, we did get, though, in the
Yeah.
West, we did get our own Jacobins. So Mostock was inherited instead by the Jacobins here. And then, of course, you get the Hitlers and the Stalins of the world instead, who were not Muslim. So the problem is that we are constantly fighting the Pillar Saints and the Boy Pharaohs. And when we are vulnerable and we feel we've been cheated onto an equation we were promised, which is exactly like sitting in a cuckoo's nest in social media today, then we are also vulnerable to these messages. We even have now in Sweden, Swedish young men who convert to Islam because they find it attractive, whereas their girlfriends go off, split up from them, and convert to the Greta Thunberg sect and become fanatical ecologists instead. But it's just the same thing. It's the same thing. The message is always that here's the shortcut to
Yeah.
success. And the shortcut to success is by claiming a different past than the one that actually happened.
And you have to
So,
become fully degraded as a human being before you can join
yeah.
some sort of religious cult, right?
Oh, of course.
And that's what's
Of course.
happening.
Of course. It's all
That
the
is what
call to
happening.
repent.
Yeah.
Of course, because if you repented,
You
then
can't
you're allowed
convert.
to be resentful. Exactly,
Yeah.
exactly.
You
That's it.
cannot convert because it's but you're biologically conditioned to be a human being, so you what can you do? Make love with trees or with the ground, and that's actually
Well,
what is happening.
I always said the girls around Greta Thunberg looked so innocent and, boycotted school so they could go on a climate whatever demonstration and feel good about themselves compared to their parents and superior to everybody else because they were now the good people and they were the beautiful souls, as Hegel sarcastically calls these people. So they became the beautiful souls, right? The problem is that It's only further down the line they start blowing up bombs. And now, of course, the German police have discovered that they now have an eco-terrorism problem in Germany, and they have eco-terrorists who are ready to blow up the Reichstag or whatever in Germany. We have the Bundestag today. We have the same problem here. So the girl who goes off and joins the ecology cult and the guy who goes off and joins Islam are actually identical. And they're identical in the sense that they go into this revenge mode, and they have an excuse to do it because they have an ideology based on resentment being the right thing. Like, all of history is nothing but the repetition of history. And because it's the repetition of history, then the future cannot be anything else but the readjustment of the injustices of the past. And this is the obsession with justice. Like, okay, so we've had white heterosexual men who've been seen for 3,000 years. The next 3,000 years, they may never be seen. And all the faces you will see the next 3,000 years, not a single one of them will be a white heterosexual man or a Jewish man for that matter. Apparently, they're white too these days. So you just put them in the category like, well, they were successful. Now it's our turn. So we're going to have exactly the same amount of time and exactly the same roles needed for getting the attention. And this is the totally vain game people are playing when they're not getting attention in their sitting in their cuckoo's nest. Not discovering that the only way to ever get attention is actually to give a value to somebody. How do you get an audience if you're an actor? You put on a fantastic play. You work really hard. You have tons of talent. And you are the one, the only one, who can walk up onto that stage and completely own that. And this is where we talked to Owen and raved about the Dark Renaissance. They're not going to create a mass culture. They're not going to say everybody out there is talented. They're not going to expect everybody out there to work hard. Basically, they're going to go out and say, no, there will be a small elite of artists who are talented enough and work hard enough and go into themselves enough and take the vulnerability up on the stage to actually deserve an audience. And it has to arrive there because the fake audience we're getting when we go online is just fake. Like I said, if Christ is the only one who likes your picture on Facebook, maybe it's about time you go and kill yourself. At least you can't be Christian anymore because Christ has given the light to just everybody who did anything on Facebook ever. This is the problem with Christianity.
Jesus loved you no matter
Yeah,
what.
Jesus will love you no matter what. Jesus will always talk. Jesus will always have time to talk to you no matter what it is. Always. It comes from Christianity. This is the problem with Christianity. The problem is that it promised you a little, a cheap buddy, Jesus, who would always be there for you and be entertained by you and would love to be with you no matter what. Which, of course, he isn't. There's nobody there. There's just this dreadful loneliness that people are terrified of that causes the anxiety you write about, Roberto. It's right there.
So back to the anxiety, again, what I think we've touched on this a little bit, but that's the diagnosis. What is the poison or the cure or the antidote?
Well, it's so difficult to define and to conceptualize, but there are many ways of bringing back. One thing that we urgently need is to bring back community in a certain way. And what we've been talking about and all these, let's say, empty spaces, it really doesn't do us very, it doesn't do us well. But I think that something I've been working on recently is how to not lose interest in ourselves. And we need to be interested in ourselves in a certain way in which we are not interested right now. And ta taking back and tackling back the friction, we need that, or at least a certain amount of friction in our lives to be able to handle anxiety. And we certainly are living in a world in which everything can be postponed, and we need not to postpone to be able to postpone everything. We need to accomplish some tasks and have them like certainly closed and certainly acknowledged. But I was thinking about something when Alexander was speaking, and We want revenge from all these things and all this that has happened in our past. And the one thing that Nietzsche is so acute about is that there is here a concept of time. And time for Nietzsche was, that's why, as I understand it, that's why he does speak of eternal recurrence. We need to handle differently our concept of time. If we are eternally thinking about transforming ourselves based on the past, we're going to live in a world in which we are full of hatred and anxiety about ourselves. We need to see us differently in matter of the time that we can see that we live in. That's why there is this theme of eternal recurrence. I think that Nietzsche understood it very well. In at the beginning of this book called The Antichrist, he says the very first paragraph, we are hyperboreal. We launch ourselves into space only to find that we cannot breathe the thin air in the heights. And this is exactly what's happening to us. We shall not, well, it's better not to pretend to live as hyperboreals, that we can do anything. There's this expression that I like very much that's called that people today are emotional hemophiliacs. But we like playing in very dangerous places. We like playing around in I don't know how you call it in English, where they sell crystals, the crystal shop or whatever. In Spanish, it's called La Cristalería. But we like playing there. So it's so easy to eventually get hurt. And well, I've said many, many things. I don't know how you have a take on this.
No, I think a lot of what you're talking about will happen. It will happen through the dialectical process itself, because fundamentally today, right in the middle of the paradigm shift, moving into the digital age, AI is arriving around the corner. We constantly have to adapt to these new sort of human technological environments. And we're thrown into them, like Heidegger says, but we do adapt. We were all fooled to go to Facebook, but because Facebook refused to tell us the truth. I mean, if Facebook only had had a service at the end of every year that said that we're now going to remove 30% of your claimed friends because you haven't actually socialized with them in the last 12 months, then the sociogram Facebook was supposed to produce would have been infinitely better 10 years later. Because Facebook are marketing people and their psychologists want to make us addicted to their products, nothing else, then Facebook didn't dare us tell us the bad news that actually most of our friends weren't friends at all. So we arrived at a point a few years later where we had this eerie feeling that Facebook was just throwing events and throwing products and throwing services at us that were of no interest to us whatsoever, because the friends we're supposed to know or share with others weren't even our friends. Now, if Facebook was designed in a way that we're gonna give people a qualitative experience, it might be tough on them, but at least they will go back to us because it will be a qualitative experience, but they didn't. They gave us nothing but bland entertainment that flattered us. So it's like everything, if we lived in the childhood of the internet age over the last 30 years, everything we've been given online has basically been there to flatter us and to take away the bad news so we'd have to see it, like the Tinder example I gave before. Now we arrive at a point where we realize that this is eerily the case. Now, there's only one thing we can do then dialectically, and that's a step back, retract. And then rethink what we really need and we'll spend our time on. And we take out our calendars. A lot of people are buying paper calendars again to control themselves and have only three or four things they do every day and not more than that. And therefore, they prioritize according to the calendar, which is according to our philosophy, what people would do anyway, because if space has disappeared because of digital, time will be more important than ever. This is a perfect example of a negation. It's not that the internet designed time as the most important category. It's time is what we're left with. We're going to die one day, and until the day we die, we want to plan our lives, and we don't want to prioritize anything any longer that we're not conscious of and we have ourselves decided.
I think time is the most important resource of ever. You know, it is the issue, right? Today in the internet age is time. And like you have to struggle with it. Like you're struggling with, what's the Gorgon knot? I don't know. It's a struggle with time.
I actually said it.
Again.
I had dinner with John Söderqvist yesterday. We are talking about a possible future beyond the six books, but but we had dinner yesterday, and I said, today would be striking. You wouldn't write the phenomenology of spirit like Hegel did 150 years ago.
Oh
You
no.
200 years ago, you would write strictly a phenomenology of time itself today.
Oh
You
wow.
would
Incredible.
think of time as phenomenological. That would be the ultimate philosophical project today, to be honest about it. It
Yeah.
would be.
What Alexander was saying, to answer Andrew's question more succinctly, of course, psychologically, there are some certain like simple traits that are simple things that you could do to live with a little bit less of anxiety. In the first place, to renounce to perfection, trying to be perfect. My goodness, I see my 16-year-old daughter. She lives in a world in which things have to be perfect in a certain way. Her nose has to be perfect. Her appearance has to be perfect. She is scaled up, not in comparison to a small community, but in a certain way to the world of people. And perfection is not an option. You have to be perfect. In the second place, well, you have to for learn to forgive yourself for imperfection. If you don't do this, you're going to be anxious all the time. Of course, being able to forgive yourself, and it's a psychoanalytic theme, really, not losing interest in ourselves when we find that we have flaws. And in the third place, I think it's so important learning to work for others, and it's something that. So it almost sounds religious, but it's something that we have renounced to, that our work has meaning for others, not only for me. If we could manage these three things, maybe we could make anxiety less pervasive in our lives.
I think it's a return to religion. That's what it is. But religion has to be different from what it was, because we can't go back to the religion we had. We have to rethink religion per se. And of course, Andrew and I are strong proponents of the Silk Route Triad, because of all the world religions, Buddhism, Taoism, Zoroastrianism, having been developed along trade routes and being non-dogmatic, are far superior today, because they just contain spiritual practices that are very useful. That's what I put into the mix when I say that if people come to me and ask for advice and want me to be more prescriptive, I said, well, we have those religions already. Why don't you go there? That's a good place to start. Commercialism has run its course. Capitalism has come up to us, taken us by a collar, and said, what is it that's not for sale? Right? It does so rightfully. Capitalism deserves to ask the question, because it's fundamentally, from the point of negation, it's fundamentally a spiritual question. What is not for sale? So you have to specify what in your life is not for sale. I would say my own time to begin with, but then I would certainly start mentioning a lot of people, like the people I love are not for sale, because love cannot be sold. So you can then start creating your own socion, your own sphere of the sacred and the private, which you then have a membrane around, and you're allowed to, and you will defend against those marketing forces or whatever out there that try to sneak into you and get access to you and try to manipulate you. So you can have that outside yourself. And to create that kind of integrity, what we call a personal membranics, like, I will not let that in. That's not nutritious for me. I'm not interested in that. I won't let it in. I won't let something in that just, helps me kill my time. I want my time to be valuable. I don't want time pass. I don't want the time pass things. I get them out of my life. I want quality things in my life. I want to know that every moment I wake up, I'm alive and I'm growing, but not out of perfection. And I think you're right, Roberto, because I think the subject in the subject substance dichotomy in Hegel, I think the subject today has gone completely neurotic in its drive for perfection, against a world that it perceives to be psychotic. So the more complex the world around us looks to us, the more overwhelming the world is, the more the world consists of competing cuckoos screaming at the top of their lungs, who we cannot understand. The more we have the psychosis around our society, the more neurotic we become. And it's becoming less neurotic in your subjectivity to understand the world better because it isn't psychotic, it can be understood, but it requires education to understand the world from a non-psychotic point of view. But I think that's the journey ahead of us.
There's another thing that I would like to say about Andrew's question, and I think Nietzsche understood it so well in the Gaia Science, the Gaia Ciencia, in this book. You remember the aphorism of the death of God, and the crazy man comes to the village and he says, "I have news for you. God is dead." And what do people answer? The people in the village, "Ah, we already knew that. We knew that." And the crazy man that brings the news, he says, "You knew that? Well, don't you think it's the greatest thing that humanity has ever done? And don't you think it's dangerous? And my goodness, how are we going to live now? We will fall forward and we will fall backwards and we will fall sideways, and we will not have a light at night anymore. It's like losing, like the earth losing the moon in a certain way." And Nietzsche says it's such a beautiful passage, because he says, while the wild man was crazy man was speaking, others would cough. And he was so ignored. But there is a great concern with this blind nihilism. And what actually Nietzsche was working on towards the end of his life was a treatise about European nihilism. And I think he was so, if we bring that for our present age, it's so correct. We are like deep down in a certain kind of blind nihilism too. People do not believe, and there is they are incapable of belief. It's not that they went around belief and they found it to be disturbing or absurd or whatever. It's that they don't believe per se. They don't have beliefs per se. And what's going on? This is very, for Nietzsche at least, and I find him so correct here. This is something that he worries about a lot. Of course, he's not defending the existence of God, but he is saying, how can you renounce the belief on these terms? It is problematic, and we need to go back and think the reasons that we have to be nihilistic. And I think we need to examine that too. The very young people, I see it in my daughter too, think that there's like this belief. I don't know if I'm right on this one. There's nothing new to be said. Everything has already been said. And this great amount of knowledge that pertains to the past and comes from the past, it's just knowledge that it's not even worth trying to acquire. It's too much. It's the effort is enormous. So the only thing I can do with beauty and knowledge is just appropriate it. Take it. Make it mine. It belongs to humankind in a certain way. Because nothing new can be said. Nothing new can be ascertained. And of course, that's one of the sources of our anxiety. But I don't know how.
I would say the having worked on nihilism a lot, taking the cue from Nietzsche like you do too, I'd say there are four stages. There's the naive nihilism, you don't know you're a nihilist yet. There's the cynical one, you know you're a nihilist, but you won't admit it in public because you're actually going to milk the public arena for not being nihilist while you are. Like I said, when Hillary Clinton goes to church on Sunday, we know she's not a Christian. She's a cynical nihilist. And the world is full of cynical nihilists today. There's also the healthy reaction, I think, which is your daughter, which I call the ironic nihilist. And in the sense, there's something about the ironic nihilist who's always permitted. Max Bord is wrongly called cynical nihilist ironic. I'm going to correct him on that one in a conversation with Sweeney later this spring. But because ironic nihilism is actually liberating in the sense that it just says that this is what it is, period. Right? I can still create values on top of that. So ironic nihilism is the beginning of a process towards what Nietzsche loves, which is the affirmative nihilism, which is like God is dead. Thank God he's dead, because then we create another God. A God we can more believe in, that's more valuable for our time, there's more ours. Nothing wrong with the old gods, we need a new God. So the affirmative is the goal. And this was the goal for Nietzsche, it's the goal for me when we talk about going on this sort of go the opposite direction from the online world, which is going to religion. Then of course bring it online, because we're all living online, we can't avoid that. But to bring that spirituality to this, the dark renaissance, the gray robes Max Bord is dealing with, your work in Colombia, Roberto, all of this works together, points towards that this is a great time to do a spiritual journey. And the ironic nihilist says, this is a great time to do the spiritual journey.
Oh,
Once
yeah.
the ironic nihilist goes on the spiritual journey, he becomes affirmative. So I think what we talk about here, what Nietzsche is concerned with, is that if we stay in a mode of cynical nihilism, it will tear us down completely and we'll go down with it.
Yeah.
And we have no guarantee we're not gonna get out of cynical nihilism. I would say the marketing people out there, politicians out there, when I saw Harvard tearing itself apart in front of the US
Oh my goodness,
Congress.
yeah.
Yeah, that was cynical nihilism. That was nothing but cynical
Yeah,
nihilism.
it was absolutely yes.
It was amazing to see this huge institution blowing itself up to that extent that Harvard just did. Carolyn Gay, we can't blame her for it. She was underqualified like hell to have that job, apparently. And this just shows that cynical nihilism won't work. But right now, say the states we're in historically is cynical nihilism. The old institutions try to defend themselves against the new. Digital is arriving big time, and it's going to get worse, not better. In a
Yeah,
few
it's
years'
not going to
time,
go away. Yeah.
in a few years' time, we'll not be able to trust a single picture or a single sound in our lives any longer. That's going to terrify us. It's going to terrify us that we can't trust anything. So it's not just that we try to create a tiny little space of the sacred, of the private that we can defend against this huge profane public arena out there, which is more profane than ever and demands our attention. We're trying to create that sacred private little space here. But once we are in connection with the outside world and look outside of it, the pictures and the sounds that affect our senses are completely untrustworthy.
So, but the big question here is, where is that spirituality going to come from? Because we're not going to go back to the like Steven Pinker maybe thinks. We're not just going to go back to the old ideas of the 18th century illustrated society. That's not going to happen.
I believe in digital monasteries, and I mean it. I believe in that, living with other people who are in the same predicament that you are, and then using the technologies with consciousness, like you use the technologies, for example, to create great art. If you use your laptop, your smartphone in the conscious way, rather than just being pulled in by it, if you turn off all the damn ads, if you throw them in the spam box, and you aggressively say, I'm going to use this tool to fight back. Because, for example, if you suffer from a psychiatric disease today, because you've been too much online, I'm sorry, you have to download an app to get treatment for it. It's just that the internet has swallowed everything. We have to accept that. I don't think we can get out of it, but I think we can start consciously using it through dialectical process, because you're using it in a way that actually we push the technology rather than the other way around. I think we have
Yeah,
to.
it's interesting, Alexander. Roberto. I just was
Go
thinking
ahead,
about,
please.
I understood affirmative, what you called affirmative nihilism is that everything really sucks today on many levels. And this is like hallelujah, because there's a way in which that's why the Gurdjieff movements and things like that come in, because this is possible in a way that wasn't before, because everything else is so rotten to the core, all the institutions, etc. It's the best time to do spirituality.
Yeah,
Does that make
but
any sense, or
for me, yeah, no, it makes sense to me. The big question is, where is it going to come from? Because we do not see redemptive Like the public is not a redemptive sphere anymore. Politics certainly is not a redemptive sphere. Religion is not a redemptive sphere. Education is not a redemptive sphere.
Well, the
And the
institutions aren't, right?
basic and the basic idea of illustration has gone to trash, really. And it was a beautiful idea in its time. If you want to construct a society of people that are basically, let's say, artists, well, have art in the public realm. And this will make
I think it's going to happen, Roberto. I think it's already
and
happening. We
this.
just haven't seen, we have only seen the first traces of it yet. But when we talk about the dark Renaissance, we talk about the gray robes, these are these things. They are from the future. We're already discussing them and they are materializing and they do engage people intensely. So we're gonna have to finish it off here. Obviously, we guys can't stop talking, but I would just want to throw this last question out to you, Roberto, directly. I was in Latin America this last fall and spent a lot of time there, and I both did sort of hardcore historical one, which is Chavín culture in Peru. I also did the really hopeful one, which is that I stayed with Prospera on Roatán Island in Honduras.
Roatán.
Roatán is a fantastic place right now. So I think I both got a taste of an amazing future and a thrilling past of Latin America on my trip with my friends this last 6 months. And I intend to come back. But if I start seeing here in Europe where Andrew and I live, we start seeing the dialectical reactions, if we at least see the ironic nihilism maturing into an affirmative one. That, like Andrew said, that this is a golden opportunity actually to pursue spirituality when nothing can be trusted in the outside world. It's just that the old institutions are done. You don't need them. You don't need the universities any longer. You don't need politics any longer. You can get along without these old institutions. You better get over them. You don't need the newspapers any longer to get informed. If you can get rid of the old institutions and realize they're all screaming from like the death states more than anything, and you can start living now in a world where your physical world and your online world can actually be matched with each other and make perfect sense, we can go towards the affirmative. Can you give us any sign you've seen in Latin America, in Latin American culture today, maybe in opposition to the United States, where Latin American culture has something where you use the digital realm creatively in a new way? You see any
Yeah,
signs of that yet?
it's a tough question, and because if you go 50 years back, and so Latin America was the future, and it never really turned out to be future. And what's specific about Latin America, and it's many authors have been like writing about this in recent years. For example, the chronist Martín Caparrós has a book called Ñ América with the ñ. It's N with a like the little sign on top of it that's specific to Spanish. And it's difficult to single out why there could be promise in Latin America. Our productive system, Colombia, for example, is planted everywhere with palm trees that are used to make oil or something like that. Is it really? Is that what is specific to us? My goodness, this really means nothing. We've actually gone back a long way there.
Wait, I have to correct you on that one. You have the most affirmative nihilistic nightlife in the world in Bogota. And if the big war between kicks over the next 10 years is going to be the war between cocaine and ketamine, at least you're producing half of that war. It's
No.
coming
We've
out of
lost that war
Colombia.
with
No,
fentanyl.
are you making ketamine in Colombia too, or what? Or have you
Well,
outsourced it to the Chinese? You see, no, I have great hopes.
people
We
may
got
make.
it. We got it. We've overrun the 90-minute limit we have for the Sweeney
But
versus Farr
let me
conversation.
say something
Please do. Please do.
that may sound stupid, as many things maybe I've said here. But the concept of time is certainly different in Latin America. And if you take a look at it, in the 18th century, Wilhelm von Humboldt came to the New World to measure the laws of nature to see if they work the same here as in Europe. And of course, he found that the measurements of Newton's gravity and so on were the same here. But the basic standard points, time and space, were not. Especially time, as we have. In a city like mine, people are living in different time zones, but I do not refer to the CET and stuff like this. Some people live in 1970s, the 70s. Some people live back in the 200 years ago. Some people live in the future. And that's so specific about our ways of life. What we dream about and how we imagine and construct our time and our space do not seem to resemble what I've seen in other places. We're more or less living in the same time span.
That's a nice place, maybe, to conclude, huh? I like that, that you're living in a different, we're living in different times. Yeah, that's beautiful. And anyway, I want to.
I'm really thrilled to have having this conversation. I would call the Latin American answer to Byung-Chul Han. We can start there. There's much more to Roberto Palacio. I highly recommend the book, Age of Anxiety, in Spanish, preferably. That's the original language here. But you know, whatever you like. It's just great having this conversation. I'm looking forward to the continuation of this conversation for sure.
Thank
Yeah,
you.
I'd like to do
Thank
it
you.
again, and it's really
I'm
nice to get to know your mind a little bit and your thoughtful way of looking at the world, and it's been great. Thanks a lot, guys.